Okay, the Civil Justice Committee meeting will come to order. We do have a quorum, and first of all, Representative Jackson moves the minutes of March 16th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carried 1-0. Okay, the first business will be Representative Sanders. Somebody want to move his bill?
I'll move the bill.
Representative Scott moves House File 166, and this goes to the General Register. You've been in the other committees, I guess. So Representative Sanders, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, House File 166, is a bill that prohibits retailers from knowingly selling recalled products. And those are products that have been recalled for safety reasons either by the federal government, the manufacturer, the wholesaler, the distributor, or the importer. This bill does not give any reasons for a recall, but just says simply if it has been recalled, that they must be pulled off the shelf. Minnesota is one of a handful of states that does not have to pull products off the shelf. So we're just making this airtight. This is lining up with federal law and puts the Department of Commerce actually allows them to have some intervention here. And part of why I believe we're here is the misdemeanor that the Department of Commerce can pursue against a retailer if they do not pull a knowingly or selling knowingly a recalled product. That'll stand for any questions.
Actually, Representative Sanders, I believe the reason you're here is Section 325F is in this committee. It's not the crime. You've already passed the crime committee.
Perfect.
So you pass commerce and you pass crime. Is there any discussion of the bill? Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sanders, as this bill would not apply to the secondhand stores, whether it's the Goodwills or the other charitable secondhand stores?
Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. In fact, we worked this out with the Minnesota Retailers Association and the toy industry to insert the language knowingly selling a recalled product, and therefore believe that those thrift stores, secondhand stores, garage sales, then would not be affected by this, and that is our intent.
Okay, any other further questions? Okay, Representative Scott renews her motion to pass House File 166 and send it to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Was there a Representative Gardner, you have two bills. We'll do the one for House File 403 first. Does somebody want to move House File 403? Representative Mahoney moves House File 403 to where? To the General Register, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, there's a very small financial or fiscal note, and so go to Representative Lugini at this Committee of Environmental Finance. I guess I'll go to Finance.
So it has to go to Finance Committee, then they decide where it goes after that. Okay, thank you, Representative Gardner. And I believe you have an A5 amendment?
That's correct. I have an author's amendment, which actually tweaks some of the language related to enforcement and civil penalty in Section 2, Subdivision 3 of the bill.
Okay. Representative Mahoney, I assume, moves the A5 amendment to get it in the author's, the way the author wants it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead and explain your bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll just speak to Section 2, if that works for you.
That's the only part for us.
We have, I've worked in the solid waste and recycling and composting field for about 10 years before I was elected, although I don't now. We have a problem where people are using compostable bags to be able to reduce the amount of plastic that goes in our yard waste, which reduces the value of compost and makes it difficult for the private sector to locate and source high-quality compost. In most of the committees I've been on, people find this all a very weird topic, so I just thought I'd get that out right away. The problem is we have people selling bags which are claimed to be biodegradable and not compostable, and that in itself sounds pretty strange. But there actually is no scientific standard of any kind for the word biodegradable. And here's an example of a bag that is biodegradable. It's made in Indonesia with a additive that makes it degrade, but it doesn't actually completely break down. And these are compostable bags. We actually have five compostable bag manufacturers here in the state of Minnesota. There is an ASTM standard for the compostable bags. There is no ASTM standard for biodegradability, and so people are selling products that don't actually do it. Well, we don't know what they do because there's no standard. And so by January 1st, 2010, this bill would require that no bag that's a bag can't be labeled as biodegradable. And then there's a civil penalty here in Subdivision 3, and I inserted with the author's amendment the word willfully, so that you really have to go out of your way to sell the bags that are not in compliance with the law. And then I realized that I had a typo here where the Subdivision 3B needs to include Subdivision 1 and 2. And also on 2.20, so it applies to Subdivision 1 and 2. Does that make sense, Mr. Chair?
Representative Gardner, I think so.
Well, the author's amendment essentially clears up clerical error and then make sure that there has to be some willful intent to violate the statute.
Yes,
rather than
yeah.
allowing some accident.
I think it makes sense, that part. Is there any Representative Holbrook?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, the penalty is only for the retailer, not for the consumer. Is that correct?
Representative Gardner.
Chair, Representative Holbrook, that is correct. There's nothing in Section 1 related to the, you know, requiring to use those bags for yard waste or the composting programs. There's no penalty involved with that. I was just going to mention, since you asked Representative Holbrook, this is Section 1 is actually something that is in place in ordinance in Dakota County already for the last 15 years. You can't dispose of yard waste in a non-compostable bag, and that's been in place for about 15 years, and that just be with expanding it to the 7-county metro.
Is there any other discussion? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, the word willfully, do we need a definition for that word there? I expect that that word is going to be the focal point on any controversy around whether or not people violated this provision.
Representative Gardner. Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I was assisted by House Research on the use of the word willfully. Not being an attorney and not being familiar with that section of our statutes, I took his advice and reinserted the word willfully.
Okay, then seeing no further, Representative Mahoney.
And law challenge, then, as opposed to many people in this committee, so I'm not an attorney.
Lucky. Representative Mahoney renews his motion to send House File 403 to Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Carries. Representative Gardner, you might as well just stay there. Does somebody, Representative Mahoney, you're going to, on a roll, you're going to move House File 239 to the general register. Let's see, Representative Gardner, do you want to go ahead and present your bill?
Certainly,
Mr. Chair. And that's your witness on this?
Oh, no, this is not my witness. But I feel like we've gotten to know each other.
I'm happy to be a witness.
Mr. Chair, House File 239 is one of several homeowner protection bills that several of us have moving through the legislature. This one deals with the cost that a consumer may try and recover if there's a breach of warranty by a home builder or a home remodeler. Originally, the bill got rid of all limits to damages in 327A.05, for warranty breaches, and I reinserted the parts that are on 1.12 to 1.14 and added the need for reasonable cost for short-term housing, and that's 1.15 to 1.17. And the reference you see there has to do with a maximum per diem rate for a lodging set by the U.S. General Services Administration. So if you're a federal employee, if you're traveling on some federal contract of some kind, there's a master list of maximum not to exceed dollar figures for lodging per day for people who are traveling. And so if you're out of your house as a result of warranty repair work, you would be able to recover the costs if there's a breach of warranty for that not to exceed number. And I had it say so that rate has to apply to the location of the property, so you couldn't be in Shoreview where I live and have to be out of your house and check into a swanky hotel in Minneapolis. You'd have to go to the swanky Hampton Inn in Shoreview if you're out of your house. But that's it in a nutshell. It's been through Labor and Consumer Affairs and Commerce and Labor, and now it is here, and it's gone through a couple changes where we've whittled it down to a very precise additional item here that can be recovered, and maybe I'm possibly Ms. Burnett is here to give a rousing endorsement of the bill. I don't know.
Well, since there's Gardner, it keeps going on a diet all the time, and it's a lot different from what I originally saw, and now it's down to almost nothing. So I guess you might be right, but she doesn't seem to be nodding yes.
She's smiling a lot more than she was.
And as I recall in Commerce, it was Ms. Weaver that testified on it, I thought, wasn't it?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Lisa Furnett with the Builders Association of Minnesota, and Representative Gardner's comment makes me think of the song, When You Wish Upon a Star. I wish that I could help out with this. And Ms. Weaver was in Commerce because I was over in Judiciary in the Senate going through all six bills that were immediately passed to the floor on the warranty issues. So she was filling in for me.
I thought because I remembered having to correct one statement she made about the effect of the bill. But Ms. Burnett, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Representative Gardner, we appreciate very much that you have been willing to work with us on reducing the amount of damages that a builder would have to pay for housing from where it originally started. We, however, are still uncomfortable with the language. We feel it's subjective. Who's going to decide when and how long a homeowner should have to move out? Another part of our discomfort is that the bill is sitting on the Senate floor as it was introduced here in the House, and we're not sure how that's going to match up as it goes along the process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wants to testify on it? Nobody else wants to testify? Okay, then questions. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I guess maybe for the author, but maybe Ms. Furnett would chime in on this, but on the, you're saying, is the presumption that they go to a hotel if they're displaced from their house, and is that just for a 1 or 2 or 7 day displacement? If a breach causes a longer displacement, is there any direction that they find cheaper housing than a hotel, such as short-term rentals, apartments, things like that?
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, the line reads, reasonable cost for short-term housing made necessary as a result of the breach. We don't define short-term. I don't know anybody who really wants to be out of their house that long, but I suppose if you've taken the whole place down, you may have to look at that possibility. My suspicion that someone in the judicial system, a judge, is reviewing any case would say, okay, if you stayed in the back room at Grandma's house, that wasn't the Hampton Inn, so I'm not going to grant you $70 a day or whatever the number is. That would have to be up to the judge. But one comment that Ms. Burnett and others have made in previous committees is that you know, how do you decide when someone really needs to leave the house? If your tile scratched a little bit, does that mean you get a industry-sponsored junket somewhere? And my response is you know, we could have about 10 pages of legislation to determine exactly under what specific conditions you would have to leave your house. But I think every house is different and every situation is different, and I thought that would be a little bit too meticulous and nitpicky to try and do that. And, you know, there might be someone who's trying to measle some money out of the system, but I've just run into dozens of homeowners who have just said, we have had so many out-of-pocket expenses just to be out of the house, because we couldn't be in there because of the dust or because all the plumbing was shut off or something, that they'll be assisted by this bill.
All right, thanks.
Representative Gardner, yeah, came up in this committee. One of the witnesses testified he'd been doing consumer law since the beginning of time, and I realized that I had been practicing longer in consumer law than he had, so somehow before the beginning of time. But yes, judges in this use the word reasonable, and they make people justify it. So they wouldn't be able to stay in something for a long time if there was a cheaper way to do things. Representative Scott, are you?
No.
I'll
be.
Which?
Me.
You're first? Okay. Oh, you're not even in? Oh, okay. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. I got mixed up. Representative Mahoney's next. Lynn Kelly. And Scott's not on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, Ms. Finette, would this be something that could be covered under insurance? If I'm going to assume, I'm going to guess, I'm going to take it at its face that this is kind of related to the warranty bills that are, the other five or six warranty bills coming along. And my concern is if the insurance companies eventually pay for the repair of a home, the builders would be able to recover this cost also from an insurer in that fashion under those circumstances. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I'm assuming that's part of the equation, unless it's AIG, and then it's kind of, you know, all bets are off, I guess. But
it would be a swank hotel.
Yeah.
With 90% tax credit.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I'm of an understanding that there are insurers that are already paying for people to out-of-pocket expenses to stay someplace else, and I do believe that if there was another bill moving and the insurance companies had, or the homeowners had the ability to directly go after the insurers, that they would be able to recover these costs also.
I hope we get there.
Thank you. Representative Kelly, then?
I think Mr. Chair, Mr. Mahoney asked my specific question.
Oh, okay. Looks like there's no further. Representative Mahoney renews his motion to pass House File 239 and submit to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next file.
If you do have to leave the house, make sure you guard your copper pipe. I discovered it.
Yes. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 702 be recommended to pass and be sent to Finance with the recommendation that it be sent to Public Safety Finance.
Representative Hillstrom, go ahead and present your
motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is regarding some data that's collected regarding children's status within the juvenile justice system. And this was brought to me by the Juvenile Justice Coalition, and I would like to turn it over to them, Mr. Chair.
You have to state your name and position.
My name is Cheryl Krager. I'm the Associate Director with the Juvenile Justice Coalition of Minnesota. And this bill was identified as a top priority by our legislative group, which is composed of individuals, organizations, professionals, associations, and other folks that work in the juvenile justice system. And it is part of one of the four core requirements of the Juvenile Justice Delinquency and Prevention Act, which is a federal legislation governing juvenile justice across the country.
Could you speak up a little?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
We can barely hear you, and so the record may not be picked up.
Okay, I'm sorry. It is, the act, this part of the act requires states to collect data at key contact points within the juvenile justice system. It requires states to develop a plan if they identify any disproportionate minority contact as a result of that data. Minnesota currently is actually collecting the majority of the data required with this federal legislation, but we do have some missing data. We're not collecting referrals to county attorneys, cases diverted, and cases resulting in delinquency findings. And so because there's no state mandate right now to collect the data, the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Program staff are required to submit the report to the Federal Office of Justice Program. Quite honestly, have to kind of scramble, and it's really difficult for them to collect all the data. It's scattered among different agencies within our state and different counties, and they don't have the capacity to go to all 87 counties to get some of the data. The Juvenile Justice Delinquency and Prevention Act is currently up for reauthorization this year in Congress, and it has always historically had very strong bipartisan support. With the new legislation, they're looking at strengthening this component of the federal legislation, and part of that is to add details to the data that states are currently being required to collect. And so this bill reflects not only the current mandates of the federal legislation, but also the anticipated changes coming up with the new legislation. And that detailed list of the data is critical because it really helps us identify the reasons behind the disparities that we know exist here in Minnesota within our system. The other piece that we've heard is that the Federal Office of Justice Program is going to be a lot more vigilant in making sure that states are in full compliance with this component of the Act. Currently, Minnesota is technically in compliance, but they're repeatedly being told you need to collect the missing data that you're not fulfilling as this requirement. The penalty if states are out of compliance with this requirement is a 25% reduction in federal dollars that we receive through the federal legislation, and that states are then required to spend up to 50% of the remaining dollars on getting in compliance. Currently, we get about $2 million with this legislation. With the new bill up in Congress, we're looking at trying to get the authorization or appropriations back to 2002 levels. Minnesota got $6 million in 2002. The other piece with this is that we know that state agencies are looking at how they can implement this bill and trying to make this just easier to collect all of this data. We also have a group led by Professor Wavy Pounds with St. Thomas's Community Justice Project and our organization to look at how to make the data more consistent in terms of the racial and ethnic categories. Right now, it's sort of different across the board. And so we're working with state agency folks and using guidelines developed by Pennsylvania and Illinois that they're already using successfully to address this issue. So basically, this bill is to make sure that Minnesota meets the current legislative mandate for collecting the data and also the anticipated changes in the new legislation, and for us to collect the data to address disparities within our system, and really to also help us make the system better for all kids.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Excuse me. My name is Makuma Levy Pounds, and I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas. I'm also an attorney. I am here as an advocate primarily on behalf of the children who are involved in our criminal justice system, our juvenile justice system in the state of Minnesota. I have conducted research, and actually my scholarly agenda focuses on the impact of the war on drugs on poor women of color and children. And we also have a number of programs within the community where we actually go out into local public schools at the elementary, junior high, and high school level. At schools where there are there's a high number of poor children of color, and one of the things that we're seeing is a lot of overlap in terms of poor children of color and their involvement in the juvenile justice system. We also know that schools have become in some ways a pipeline to the juvenile justice system, because about 25% of cases that end up in the juvenile justice system are actually coming from the public school system. And many of those cases are involving school fights that perhaps don't involve a weapon, and other behaviors that schools are not dealing with internally. And I believe that primarily that's because of a lack of resources such as having social workers on staff, grief counselors, etc. And so schools are more likely to refer cases over to the juvenile justice system rather than handle these cases in-house. And so what that has led to is a huge disparity in terms of our juvenile justice system. And for example, in terms of some of the disparities that we've seen, youth of color are overrepresented at every key decision point in Minnesota's juvenile justice system: arrest, referral to juvenile court, detention, petition, probation, confinement, and adult certification. The rate of arrest among youth of color is 3 times higher than the rate of arrest for white youth. 2.5 times more likely to have cases involving secure detention, and youth of color are almost 2 times more likely to have their case transferred to adult court than our white youth. Conversely, youth of color are much less likely than white youth to have cases resulting in probation. And so there is a huge disparity happening right now. When we go into the schools, one of the things that is shocking to us is to talk to fifth graders in local public schools. We were just at one yesterday. And the teacher said many of our kids are already in the system. And you look at these children and you recognize these kids are not criminals. You know, these kids may have made a mistake. They may have gotten into a fight. They may have underlying issues related to anger or mental health, because many of the kids in our juvenile justice system do have high rates of mental health issues. Additionally, there is a very low literacy rate. About 85% of children who interface with our juvenile justice system actually are functionally illiterate. And so what we're seeing is a disconnect in terms of how we are actually addressing some of these underlying issues that are facing children and the needs that these children have. And there is not enough evidence to show that the needs of these children who are chronically poor, who are primarily children of color, who are overrepresented in our juvenile justice system, and who have high rates of mental health issues, are being treated effectively within our juvenile justice system. And so by passing this particular legislation, we would have an opportunity to ensure that the children who are in the system actually belong in the system. And I can just give you a quick example of what happened in Ramsey County in 2004. In 2004, Ramsey County admitted 3,124 youth into secure detention. 71% of them were youth of color. Only 22% were for violent crimes, weapons, drugs, or sex. And so that shows that in about 78% of the cases, someone used discretion to decide to incarcerate a child rather than to look for a community alternative for a child. And there's a huge cost impact here, because it costs $311 to place a child in secure detention, $311 per day versus $60 per day for a community-based alternative. And so in the state of Minnesota, you know, we need to show the example that we are leaders and that we care about our children. And so this legislation provides us with an opportunity to basically be gatekeepers and ensure that every child that is in the system is there because they belong there, not because of some other influence. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to have all... Ms. Bray, were you going to testify? No? Oh, okay. Is there any other testifiers anyone else that wants to testify? Okay, are there any comments? Representative Holberg, Scott? Representative Holberg first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who can... I have two kind of issues, and Representative Hillstrom, your first testifier said we were in compliance but not doing everything, so could you expound on that a little bit? I'm not sure if we're in compliance or in compliance and to be eligible for the money, I guess, from my perspective, so I'm wondering...
Ms.
If that's
Crager,
not the case, what
you
is.
Asked Representative Hillstrom, but do you want Ms. Crager?
Well, I'm trying to respect the fact that it's the author's bill and whoever she wants to.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, do you want to defer to Ms. Crager? Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's my understanding that we are technically in compliance currently with the current federal legislation, but that the state repeatedly gets a letter from the federal office saying we need you to collect this missing data, so we are technically on compliance. But it's also my understanding that the new federal legislation that is currently moving through Congress, the idea is that states are going to be held basically to be in full compliance and not be allowed to have any more missing data that they've been currently allowed to have. And so with the new federal legislation, we will have to collect all of that data to be in full compliance with the Act.
All right. Thank you. And then my second issue that I'm concerned about has to do with page 2 of the bill, subdivision 3. And we've always worked really hard as a legislature to keep identity of juveniles private. And as I'm looking at the amount of data that's necessary to be reported, it may not be an issue in some of our larger counties, but if you look at all those data points and are looking at a county with, of 3,000 total population, I'm very concerned that there's enough information there to figure out who we're talking about. And so is the report in the first half of Subdivision 3 under A, is that a public report? I mean, and certainly the report under a paragraph B is, and then it's going to the legislature, but how public is the report under paragraph A?
Ms. Krager, I
assume. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the data would all be aggregate data from the statewide, so you wouldn't be able to bring it down to the county level to be able to identify kids. The other thing is the information wouldn't be able to identify individual kids. It's just collecting that aggregate data within the counties and within each of these contact points. So there is no way you would be able to see which county has this many kids and who identify who those kids are. The way the data is reported and the way it's collected and within that national, that report that would be public. So basically it would say we arrest, like in 2006, about 54,000 juveniles were arrested in the state of Minnesota, and it would say what percentage of those were African American, what percentage were white, what percentage were Hispanic. So it wouldn't get down to that local level.
If you look at lines 22 through 24, it says that they must specify the child's race, ethnicity, gender, county of residence, county of offense, and age. And you start stacking up all those data points.
Ms. Krager?
Mr. Cameron, we'll work on that to make sure that there shouldn't be any identifying information, but we'll make sure that that's
well, and I mean, I
understand your concern.
Like I said, that if you're out in rural Minnesota, it's only 3,000 people in the county, and everybody kind of knows something happened, but they're not quite sure. And if, in fact, this now the situation that we have with data miners scooping up information, and you may have a situation in which an incident occurred in a community that involved adults and minors, and being able to put all this together becomes pretty easy.
Okay, the next one was Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing the last testifier mentioned was rather than putting these children in a juvenile facility, putting them in a community-based alternative.
Yes.
And I'd like to know what, if you could define what one of those might look like, if I could.
First, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Felton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted you to know that that is even the Department of one of the Department of Health's initiatives. The Department of Health has a bill that's going forward saying that unless the juvenile is a harm to themselves or a harm to others, that they must be placed in a community-based setting. So I just wanted you to know that the agency does have a proposal out there. In addition,
I can give an example from Ramsey County. The Ramsey County Commissioners, within the last couple of weeks, just released $1.1 million for community-based alternatives to the Ramsey County Community Corrections. And some of those alternatives include community coaches as well as evening learning centers. And as far as community coaches are concerned, young people who are not a danger to themselves or a flight risk will actually be placed with a coach from the community who will work with them over a six-week period of time to ensure that they return to court and to ensure that they follow any terms of probation, for example. There's essentially a safeguard to ensure that the children don't return to the juvenile justice system between their initial point of contact and their next court date. In terms of the evening learning centers, from my understanding, those will be places where young people can go in the evening where they are required to report there, and they will receive help with reading and any type of tutoring that they need to further their educational goals. They do have other alternatives that include home monitoring systems and things like that that seem a little more punitive than the current alternatives that Ramsey County is in the process of implementing.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not going to go on to a long lecture I did the last time. But I have a couple concerns. First, on Representative Holberg's questions, I would like to verify that it's not only counties as small as he's saying. In my county of 13,574, if I listed everything you're asking me to list on this page, I could tell anybody on the street could tell you exactly who I was referring to. Beyond any doubt, they could tell me the exact name of the person without me having never revealed the name personally.
I understand.
So that's one point. The other thing that does bother me about your bill is the question of some of this is current now, and some of it's anticipated. And I'm not going to want a long sermon on this, but my concern is I was in a different committee not too long ago where there was a concern about a horse bill, and we were going to adapt a rule to worry about what the federal government may or may not pass as a horse rule. So are we starting to get into a situation in this legislature where we're going to anticipate what the federal government may do on every single area and pass laws in advance of what they're passing?
Mr. Chair. Mr.
Chair. Representative
Hill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Typically, that would not be the case. It's something that I would do, but to go from $2 million to $6 million at a time of such difficult economic times, I want us to be in a position to take the money, and that's why we're going to Representative Tamar's committee, Representative Olin.
Yeah, just one last comment on that.
Representative Olin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom, and I understand that, but the thought really is more to do with the fact that I'm a little concerned about setting the precedent where we're jumping on anticipated new rules. And I'm also would say that if the federal government were to pass exactly what you expect to pass, somebody is going to notify us, and whether or not we have the state statute, we're going to have, as prosecutors, which I used to be, or as court system or whichever one of your entities is going to have to follow the federal law, whether we have the state law or not.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, it does sound like there's some concern about, and maybe Representative Holberg would want to get into that, whether this should be considered as far as public versus private data or something. There seems to be quite a bit of concern about opening it up. But we'll go next to Representative Kelly and then Representative Jackson.
Mr. Chair, and really to either one of the testifiers, with the data that you were given, it seems like you've identified the issue, really. So my concern is, as we listen through this in public safety and public safety finance, it seems like in this time of our deficit problem, should we really be focusing on creating more reports and more reporting out of our agencies as opposed to working on the problem? It seems like you've already identified the problem, and now instead of putting resources towards that, we're just creating more of the bureaucracy part.
Representative Ms. Frager.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we currently already are collecting the data, but we need the data to help us address those solutions. So this is just ensuring that we collect all of that data that we need, and it's the detail that we need to address the issues, but I do understand your concerns.
Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand we're already collecting data, but I think Representative Olin has said a number of times how many times he's going to have to think about whether we have to report or not. But just because we're collecting the data that you gave suggests that you know what the issues are. So how is collecting more data going to help you?
Mr. Chair.
Our representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, the data is not collected in the same format. They don't collect it in the same way. Different counties, different places. And so it's very difficult to come up with meaningful data because the interpretation of how it is reported. And so, again, most of this is reported. It's just not very useful. And so originally, I started off saying, well, if we're recording things in a way that isn't useful, should we even be recording and recording? The challenge is we have to record and report to get the money. And so if we're going to do it, we should at least do it in a useful way.
Ms. Paul.
Additionally, the reason that we know, for example, what happened in Ramsey County is because they adopted
an initiative called Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative and Disproportionate Minority Contact. So this, they actually undertook evidence-based practices in order to get this specific information. But it's not collected with this level of specificity across counties in Minnesota. So that's part of the reason why we're in support of this particular legislation, to get more information specifically related to race and ethnicity.
Representative Jackson.
I just want some confirmation to make sure I'm understanding the data, when it's public, when it's not. I know already the data about juveniles remains private, and there's always an offense report, and it seems to me that it's aggregated at the point that it's released to the legislature or the federal government. So when it becomes public is when it's no longer recognizable because it's aggregate numbers. Is that correct?
Ms. Krager.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jackson, that's my understanding.
Okay, Representative Tubbs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. You're next. Representative Champion.
Oh, if I may, perhaps this is more of a comment than it is a particular question. I guess I'm a little perplexed by some of the questions. I always believe that it's important for us to ask questions, but one of the things that I've learned in my short time being here in the legislature is the importance of empirical data, especially if we want to address or identify a specific issue. If we were to use anecdotal information or evidence only, then people would say, well, what empirical data do you have in order to confirm that, even though we all can know that? And so I believe that, you know, the collection of data is important. The integrity of that information is equally as important. But what we collect it for is the driver as it pertains to how we strategically deal with the issues that are before us. And so I'm of the thought that, you know, we need to collect data. We need to protect it in every way possible. Now, that gets to, you know, something that, for lack of a better word or phrase, is near and dear to my heart, and so perhaps I should ask this question because it seems appropriate. Here's my question for any of the testifiers. As you look at, does the disproportionate numbers of children of color in the judicial system, the juvenile justice system, show up disproportionately in adulthood when there's traffic stops, or disproportionately the number of people that are incarcerated? Can we talk about that briefly? Because I think that making these connections become very important.
I don't know if these witnesses...
Mr. Chair, we're not experts in that area, so we don't want to venture down that path. Sorry.
They came with knowledge on a certain issue. I don't think they're going to try and answer every question in the world. Representative Drostowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for any of the testifiers, before we go there, I'd just like to make a statement concurrent with what Representative Olin had brought up. Our federalism, I think, is something that I'm very concerned about. And here again, as over and over again in the legislature, we seem to be a subject of the federal government, and I think this is very troubling if we continue to capitulate to everything that they bring out, and even at this point maybe anticipating what they're going to bring out, and seem to jump at every little suggestion that they have. I think that's troubling for me as we look at the construct of our government and the autonomy of Minnesota generally. My question for the testifiers relates again to the use of this data. I mean, Representative Kelly started to talk about some of the things, the observation Ms. Levy-Pounds had outlined, that we know what some of the problems are, and we know where things are going. I'm concerned with what we're going to use this data for. I mean, we're going to put this data together, and it's going to be county-based or not county-based or whatever we end up figuring out. And then it's going to be reported to the legislature. So, I mean, if it comes back to the legislature and it says there's more of this XYZ group than this one, I mean, how is that going to help us in solving what seems to be a community and family breakdown issue, and I've brought up in the past questions about why are we sending more of our problems from our schools into the justice system, and I concur with you that that's not the way we need to go. Do you get my question?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that this does from my perspective is as we're looking at legislation here and making decisions about what we should or shouldn't be doing within the juvenile justice system, for example, the Department of Health has this proposal to not remove children unless you're a harm to yourself or a harm to others. Well, the Department of Correction runs Thistledew. And so if the Department of Health is proposing something that is going to directly impact the Department of Corrections, they're on opposite sides of the very issue. We as legislators have to understand what is the right thing to do. And if we don't have data about what is effective and what isn't effective, who's getting treatment, who's not, do the people that get treatment recidivate, do the ones that don't get treatment recidivate, you know, how do they fit together? It's very difficult to evaluate these public policy decisions. So that's the reason I'm carrying the bill.
Representative Costa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hellstrom, I understand that the recidivism and some of those actions and measurements of different crimes and those types of things. But Ms. Levy Pound said the focus is going to be on racial data. I don't know that measures those things that you talked about. That seems to be of a different type of approach, a different type of measure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Alston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is race, it's gender, it's ethnicity, it's geography. For example, our boot camp. We used to keep the women and the men together. That's when I first came to the legislature. This is for adults. We used to keep them together and we ran the program exactly the same way. The Department of Corrections found that it wasn't as effective if you had it just with everybody together, but if you did it gender specifically, you actually had better results. So they made the decision to separate it out. And what we're saying here is if we look at the data and we can get down to some of these deeper components, maybe we can make some better decisions and have better results.
Representative Sullivan, I had a question. You were talking about Thistledew. I thought they had a pretty good record.
Mr. Chair, they do. However, if the Department of Health is attempting to save money by saying that you shall not place a child outside of the community unless they're a harm to themselves or a harm to others, Thistledew Camp doesn't take kids that are a harm to themselves or a harm to others. Right. And so one department's policy is going to affect the other one.
I think many of us are concerned about the Department of Health policy there because we're taking kids that aren't seriously into the system but are just barely into it and having a result that comes out and keeps them out of going further into the system. So I'm wondering where they're going at taking away something that seems to be resulting in a good result and not ending up in the system.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we actually had data, we would be able to counter argue whatever arguments they were going to make. This is all for my bill.
Let's see, Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a lot of other members have made good points. I share Representative Kelly's concern with the creation of bureaucracy, but we have this tension this year, especially as we try to eliminate mandates, of where taxpayers want us to show accountability for our spending and the policy decisions we make. And in order to be accountable, we need information. And that kind of looks like bureaucracy. And I think it's difficult to sort out when do we need it and when do we not need it. We definitely want to get rid of it when we don't need it or it's not effective. But I think the points that Representative Champion made are very important. We do have an issue with racial disparities in educational results, in incarceration, in traffic stops, and we can't hope to figure out what's working and what's not working unless we know, for example, when a white kid in Anoka County gets in a fight, what happens to that kid? When a black kid gets in a fight in Anoka County, what happens to that kid? Because then we can't say to the school district, you're treating everybody the same, or you're treating everybody different, or we're getting good results, or we're getting bad results, unless we know. And I think that the bill needs to go forward because I do think we need the data to be accountable and to make the right policy decisions down the road.
But I do think that Representative Hillstrom, if you could work with Representative Jackson or Holberg on developing some language to add to subdivision 3 on lines 2.16 and further, so that we're very clear that only aggregated data is available to the public, so that we can't have a situation where you find out which kid in which county. I think that's a legitimate concern, but I think that's something you can probably work on, and in terms of classifying the data too is something that you can work on.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is our intent to do that. We don't want those. We want to comply and get data that will be helpful for us, but we don't want the public to get data that they could specifically then find out who the child was. So that would be our intent.
Since you have to go to finance, I guess we can have it there, and hopefully it will be straightened out before it gets to the floor.
Yes, it will, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with no further questions, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 702, refer to finance with a recommendation to Public Safety Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Next, I would like to move House File 720. And Mr. Chair, I don't know that it needs to go anywhere else unless Representative Kamar's committee needs it.
Representative Hillstrom, I believe it goes to the General Register.
That would be great, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this bill was brought to me by the Uniform Laws Commission, and so I would like to turn it over to the testifiers to talk about what this bill does and why it's here.
Judge Lansing, can we? I don't know if you go by Holly anymore or Harriet or whichever.
I'm here to testify and happy to be referred to in whatever way.
Go ahead.
All right, thank you. My name for the record is Harriet Lansing, and I am a Uniform Law Commissioner for the state of Minnesota. I'm here to discuss and be a witness for the child witness testimony by alternative means, and I think that's probably somewhat self-descriptive in terms of what the bill accomplishes, or seeks to accomplish. It is an effective method of protecting children from the trauma or a traumatic reaction of testifying in court, trying to ensure the integrity of the testimony that we obtain in court, and continuing to protect the Sixth Amendment confrontation rights of defendants and respondents. Minnesota Statute 595.02 currently provides for an abridged form of these procedures in cases involving sexual contact or criminal violence. This act would extend it to all criminal, civil, and administrative proceedings. This does not affect the current balance of constitutional rights to confrontation, and I call your attention specifically to Subdivision 8, which states an alternative method ordered by the presiding officer must permit a full and fair opportunity for examination or cross-examination of the child witness by each party. In addition to being promulgated by the Uniform Law Commission, this act has also been approved by the ABA House of Delegates.
Thank you. And Judge Lansing, I can't remember the answer. And did you say whether the Bar Association has formally approved this or? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the
state one.
The American Bar Association House of Delegates has passed it. I met with, I think, based on the suggestion of Representative Hillstrom and others at the last committee meeting, I met with the Legislative Committee of the State Bar, and also on Saturday I went to the Family Law section. They've not taken a formal position at that point. They just wanted more information. They were initially somewhat opposed because they did not have information in the two things that they were concerned about, which had to do with confrontation rights. We discussed at length, and I believe they were satisfied on it, and also what the current 595.02 provided, and they were under a misunderstanding of that, which they acknowledged. So they took no formal position on Saturday in terms of this section, but I don't perceive that there is opposition to this act.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the first committee that we were in, they were here, and they spoke. And so then we agreed to work with them, and then they're not here now. So, and I haven't heard back from them that there's a problem.
Okay. Are there any questions on this bill? Okay, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 720 and refer to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we are adjourned.